it is you're listening to The Dividing Line. Greetings. Wow, that the Coogee's driving the camera crazy. Oh, no, it's pixelated. Okay, it's pixelated, so it makes me look like I'm swimming in the ocean or something. It's really weird. Hey, welcome to The Dividing Line. What we're going to do today, yes, that's much better, thank you, is we're going to start off with absolute positive absurdity. Get it out of the way. And then we got some important stuff to talk about. I hope that works for you. There's some wild stuff going on in the world. We need to get to it. But you have to make a decision. Sometimes there are things you encounter that are just so beyond absurd that you have to make a decision. I'm not going to touch that. I'm not even going to, it's just craziness, But sometimes it is just so illustrative that it's worth taking that. Now, in this situation, I know that the people that have produced this video are desperate for attention. They've got a lot of followers. Sort of scary, especially when you read their followers' comments. But they are their own little cult. They're their own little cult group. I'm referring to, some of you may recall way, way, way back, and I'd like to thank the person who sent me this, Marie. Marie sent me the smiley face cup. Oh, that's still hot. I can't talk anymore. And a little warmer over here, so my tea will stay warm. You can't see the cup. Oh, there it is. I was gonna say it's one of those little things where the smiley faces, you can't see them unless you put something hot in it, and then they show up. I think that's really cool. However, I'm fairly certain that the folks that created this video will find a way to connect that to demonism too, as you're about to see. Anyway, some of you remember many, many moons ago that I had a written debate. Not a complete written debate, as I recall, with Brother John Mary. And this was in the early 90s, as I recall. It was a long time ago. It was at least 20 years ago. Really? Okay. And I linked to it this morning on Facebook. I grabbed the search for the blog articles, and it's still there. Anyway, these folks are sede vacantists. They are ultra traditionalists. They are not Orthodox Roman Catholics. The Roman Catholics are not Roman Catholic enough for them. The Pope's not Catholic enough for them. Well, this Pope, okay. But even John Paul II wasn't Catholic enough for them. Ratzinger wasn't Catholic enough for them. These are the radical, out there in the woods, praying to Mary type folks. And they're all upset because I generally ignore them because they don't represent anybody. I mean, if you're going to do a debate on Roman Catholicism, it's probably best to represent something that's at least within the Orthodox sphere of Roman Catholicism. And they represent themselves. And they're also, quite simply, incapable of rational thought. I mean, that's really mean. Read the debate with Brother John Mary, and you'll see what I mean. They are to Roman Catholicism what Gail Ripplinger is to independent fundamentalist Baptist something like that. Okay, except they may go beyond Gail. That's pretty hard to do, but they may actually go beyond Gail Ripplinger. And so, evidently, last night, I've not kept up with them for 20 years. I was reading a little stuff on them today. I didn't have time to bring it up. They're up in, what was it again? Not Fullerton, but someplace up in New York. Evidently, they're sort of run by a team of brothers, the Diamond Brothers, Peter and Michael, I think. And if I recall correctly, I didn't have a chance to go back and read the logs on the unit that logs everything for the chat channel. But I think I was told that it was Peter that came into the chat channel. Now, you've told me that we get stuff from these guys and their fans every once in a while. Okay. You know, they are desperate for, evidently, given this video, let's put it this way, they spend a whole lot more time thinking about me than I spend thinking about them, since I haven't thought about them in a decade, at least, maybe more. Yes?
I was going to say, there's a common thread in just about everything I get from any of them, and that is how much, how very, very, very afraid you are of them.
Oh, yes.
You won't deal with, because you're terrified of them.
Yes, every day. And, yeah, these are the very bold, well, these guys would have gone on crusades, okay? You know, they think they would have. I don't know if they actually would have, but they had that kind of an attitude, let's put it that way. So, comes into our chat channel, and we call it trolling. When you come into the chat channel and you're there for a reason, but you're not honest about what the reason really is. And throughout this URL to a video that they put out about yours truly. And I seem to recall that when it was first posted, I had seen somebody say something about it on Twitter or something. I had seen, you know, like the title, and I'm just like, oh, I know who they are. Who cares? It just moved on. Didn't even look at it. And I guess that bothered them. Let me tell you something. They have spent hours and hours and hours putting this together. I mean, wow. But I guess when you live in a monastery, you don't really have anything else to be doing in life than to be sitting on the web and grabbing video.
It does kind of make you wonder that you actually have internet in a
monastery. Oh, they do. I think that's their primary field of quote-unquote ministry. As you'll see, it's clip after clip after clip of this, the dividing line. And they have to sit there and watch all of that.
You know, I did want to say that I, after watching this morning, it occurred to me that they didn't actually, as they're simply running clip after clip after clip, they didn't actually get permission. And then I realized later that, you know, it wasn't for criticism, it was for parody, because I laughed. I really laughed.
Yeah, it's...
So it's okay.
Yeah, it's fine. That's fine. Okay, so why would I play this? Well, because I've just never seen anything like this. I've never seen anything like this. I've never seen anything this ridiculous. And so I thought I would share with you. So here we go. What's it called? Vatican, what was it called? VaticanCatholic.com, I think, or something like that. I don't know. Here's just a section. What? Oh, no, I'm not plugged in, actually. You're right. There we go. Here's just a portion of this, but do you want to find out how to recognize demons? Don't go to the Bible for that. Don't go to the Bible for that. No, there's another way. And here's how you recognize demons. You actually sort of need editing software so you can stop and start videos. Because that's where you'll find it. Okay, here we go.
This video, however, will now move to considering the spiritual component. It will cover and expose what are, in my opinion, clear and striking manifestations of a demon operating in James White. Let's get into it. In our videos, we have shown that James White repeatedly flashes and displays the El Diablo hand sign, which is also known as the devil's horns. The El Diablo hand sign, or the devil's horns, looks like this. This is a picture of Anton LaVey, the founder of the, quote, Church of Satan, giving the devil's horns hand sign. James White has displayed this symbol many times, far more times than anyone I've ever seen. In my opinion, there's an obvious reason he does it. He doesn't do it deliberately, but rather the devil in White moves him to repeatedly flash the devil's horns as a sign of the wicked spirit that guides and dominates him. Let's be clear. James White's many heresies, false doctrines, and lies prove that he's of the devil. But God will sometimes allow or compel a demon to manifest its presence in someone by various external indications and signs. And with White, we're not talking about him having displayed the devil's horns once, twice, or even three times. No, he has done it many times publicly in speeches, in programs, etc. God allows him to display it over and over again because he's a false teacher of the devil. He leads people into various heresies and into hell by means of distortions, false arguments, etc. I've also noticed that when White gives the devil's horns hand sign, at least in the occasions I've seen, it's frequently when he's attacking Catholic teaching or promoting one of the many heresies of Protestantism. The fact that White frequently flashes the devil's horns is quite interesting and revealing in itself. See our documentary on justification for how that fits in precisely with the Bible's warning about Satan's ministers presenting themselves as ministers of righteousness or justification. However, in recently viewing a debate James White had in March of this year, I came across something else that provides even more striking evidence for what I'm discussing. I will be examining and critiquing portions of a public debate James White had on March 23, 2015, with another Protestant named Greg Strawbridge. Strawbridge, a Presbyterian, was arguing that infants should be baptized according to biblical teaching. White, a Baptist, was arguing that infants should not be baptized according to biblical teaching. It was a debate about infant baptism. As is so often the case, James White was defending and promoting a false and unbiblical position. He was attacking the apostolic truth that baptism and the promise of salvation in Jesus Christ is for you and your children, Acts 2:38-39, and that baptism is for you and your household, see Acts 16:15 among other verses. Even though Strawbridge, the Presbyterian, does not believe that baptism regenerates, and thus he denies the clear teaching of the Bible and the witness of the entire early church on baptismal regeneration, he is nevertheless correct that according to biblical teaching, baptism is to be administered to infants and young children who will be raised in the community of believers. Now, I'm going to play a number of clips from this debate. As you view them, look carefully at James White's face. I will also stop and freeze the video on occasion so that people can get a closer look at what's happening. What you will see, if you are observant and honest, is that White's face is actually contorting and that he is in fact making demonic faces. He does this many times in the debate, especially when he begins to attack the truth that infants should be baptized. To get the full picture, one should carefully view all the clips I'm going to cover. Here's the first clip we will consider.
And he, the jailer, took them that very hour of the night and washed their wounds, and immediately he was baptized, he and all his household.
Did you see that? Let's play that again.
And he, the jailer, took them that very hour of the night and washed their wounds, and immediately he was baptized, he and all his household.
That's not a natural facial motion at all. It is rather, in my view, a clear manifestation of the devil in White. And if you're not convinced by that one, watch this. This is from the same section of the debate.
Now, I suggest the following would be a consistent Reformed exegesis. The apostles proclaimed the gospel to all who were in the household.
Did you see that? Let's play that again.
Now, I suggest the following would be a consistent Reformed exegesis. The apostles proclaimed the gospel to all who were in the household.
He's clearly making demonic faces. There's no question about it. That's the face of anti-Catholicism, the devil. It's obvious that a demon is animating him. White actually makes these demonic and contorted faces many times in the debate, but sometimes they are made more quickly than the one we just viewed. That is to be expected, of course. Usually God will only allow something like this to be revealed very quickly or in more subtle ways. Here are some more examples.
That is not a consistent Reformed interpretation. We would never come to those conclusions using the same kind of hermeneutics that we together use to defend the deity of Christ or justification by faith. And yet I have heard that kind of argument used many times and it screams to me tradition, not exegesis.
Did you catch that? I'll play it again and freeze it.
That is not a consistent Reformed interpretation. We would never come to those conclusions using the same kind of hermeneutics that we together use to defend the deity of Christ or justification by faith. And yet I have heard that kind of argument used many times. And it screams to me tradition, not exegesis.
That's the face of a demon. James White clearly has a devil.
Okay. All right. Folks, I don't even know how to... How do you respond to something like that? There is the faith. This is a good example of why the Christian faith should never have developed monasticism. Because when you lock people in a monastery for long periods of time, they go insane. Okay? And then when you give them computers, they end up sitting there staring. What did he actually watch the entire debate in slow motion? I mean, did you watch all that? How much time? I mean, I guess it's really a good testimony as to how much impact we've had, that they think they've got to sit there and invest their life in watching this webcast in slow motion to try to find where that might happen. But what if that happens? What does that mean? Or what does that mean? Who knows? You could find something. And we all know people do this on the right and the left. You see these pictures on Facebook or news feeds and stuff. You know, it's pretty easy to do to Hillary Clinton. Bernie Sanders is a constant meme generator along those lines. But when you take anybody on video, doesn't matter who it is, and look for freeze frames, you can make anybody look silly. It's easy to do. It's child's play. Child's play. Now, I don't know what I was doing there, other than it seems fairly obvious to me. I forgot to bring him in here, but I don't wear these glasses anymore. I like them. They were a little heavy, and they were my first pair of progressives. Now, if you've never worn progressives, then stop that. Hey. I'm sure he'll find something out of that, too. See, the demon made him do it. It's great. Progressives, you get used to them. You get used to them. But you got to sort of... Well, first of all, they've got to stay in one spot. And if they're sliding, you got to get them back to where they need to be. And what I'm doing is I've got an iPad here, and I've got an audience out here. And so I'm going between two different focal lengths. And my glasses were slipping a little bit. So you just push them back up using your nose. Fairly easy to do. I don't have to do it anymore because, I didn't bring them in here. They're on my desk. I went with a wireframe thing and those Crizal lenses. By the way, Crizal. Wow. Honestly, that's what you got? They don't get dirty. I mean, I've had to wipe them maybe 5 times since I got them. And I hate dirty glasses. So, but they are the lightest. I think I measured them at 6 grams or something like that. It's just ridiculously light. So they generally don't slide. There's no weight to them. These were pretty heavy Oakleys. They're really nice.
I'm sorry. I just can't get past. Wait until Gail Ripplinger gets a little.
Oh, man.
And then the signs. Oh, good night.
Well, wait. Well,
and
wait
the Titanic's got to be in there somewhere.
Yeah. Well. Wait till the Diamond Brothers get hold of Gail Ripplinger and her videos. I mean, wow. You know, there you go from there. So I assume that's probably what it was. Part of it's just simply shadows and things like that. But the scary thing is, these guys actually believe this stuff. These guys actually believe this stuff. This is the ultra cultic form of Romanism. The ultra traditionalist, ultra cultic wacko form of Roman Catholicism. And sadly, there are a lot of people. Remember what Michael Fallon told us at the debate with Stravinskas? We were talking about it before him. Yeah, after the debate with Peter Stravinskas, Michael Fallon was standing somewhere out in the audience, and it had gone fairly late, and he was listening to some of the conversations going on. And he was listening to this Roman Catholic. He was saying, "Oh, when the Father spoke, you know, it was just so wonderful, and it was just so great to hear him speak. But when White spoke, you could see the demons circling his head." And I'm just like, "Wow, okay, there's an unbiased, especially, I mean, come on, the Stravinskas debate." That was one of the most lopsided debates I've ever done. Peter Stravinskas to this day is incredibly angry that when you Google his name, the first thing that comes up is the debate that we did on Long Island. He's, oh, the memes are flowing. Oh, Twitter's exploding with memes because, I mean, it is without a doubt the most absurd thing I've ever seen. It really illustrates just how, wow.
I have to feel sorry for Greg Strawbridge, though, because he's sitting there in a debate with you, and you're sneaking in all these anti-Catholicisms.
Yeah.
Oh, poor Greg.
Yeah.
No idea. And there's certainly nothing anti-Presbyterian in there at all. Just, no. Oh, I'll bet there is if you look deeper.
This is the face of anti-Catholicism. There you go, folks. It's... you can't make this stuff up. I couldn't believe it when I saw it, and I just thought we'd get the absurd stuff out first, so that we can move on to other things. Okay, do you have that one? Okay, let's get serious, because there's a lot of serious stuff going on. It does seem that what took place yesterday is related to militant Islam. It looks like right now, possibility of radicalization through the wife. But there's still a lot up in the air. But starting late last night, and then this morning I was running and I listened to the briefing on my run, and I listened to Dr. Albert Mohler, for whom I'm extremely grateful and thankful, discussing this image, if we can put it up there. No, the whole thing. No. There we go. The Daily News, God isn't fixing this. Now, when I first saw this, it was fairly small. And so I couldn't see what was in the stuff around it. And I couldn't read what was at the bottom. All I saw was, God isn't fixing this. Daily News, God isn't fixing this, because it was so small. And I think I misinterpreted it. When I first saw that, I saw it as a mockery of God based upon the idea that God was supposed to be somehow fixing this. In reality, when you look at it, it's mocking Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Lindsey Graham, Paul Ryan, all of who use the term prayer. Thoughts and prayers. That's the big thing now, isn't it? And, of course, I was just watching during lunch, Neil Cavuto had a section. He was really angry about this. In fact, he threw this thing across the, you know, did this thing. He was so mad about it. And it was the Secretary of State and President Obama, both of whom used the very same phrase, thoughts and prayers. And he said, so will the Daily News be coming out with something about them tomorrow? Well, of course not. Well, we understand. The hypocrisy of the communist left is well known, and the communists own the most of the media. So this is secularism in its full flower, in essence. You know, as latest batch of innocent Americans are left lying in pools of blood, cowards who could truly end the gun scourge continue to hide behind meaningless platitudes. And so, first of all, you've got the claim that somehow Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, Paul Ryan, and Rand Paul could end the gun scourge. Really? You really think that? You think those four men could do that? You really think that passing, just disarming the American public, do you think that would disarm the American public? How did that work with marijuana or drugs in general? You know, PCP and meth and coke. Total bans worked real well, didn't it? No, not really. So someone here is living on a planet where they're making things up and living in a different dimension and things like that. But then they have, I mean, honestly, just for a second, do you think that an American law is going to stop any jihadi from using a gun? Really? And where did this happen? In the Socialist Republic of California, for crying out loud. I mean, what planet are people living on when they can look at Chicago with its draconian gun laws? And how many people die every day there? And go, we just need more laws. That's just all we need. Okay, sorry. I have lost all hope in the common sense of the American voter. It's gone. It's gone. Over. Done with. Now, I just have to wonder if anybody in that place had been armed. Maybe 14 people wouldn't be dead. Maybe there might be seven, but maybe two of those would be terrorists. You never know. Anyway, then you've got the real thing behind meaningless platitudes. Now, two things. If what you mean by that is that prayer is meaningless, and you probably do mean that, I hear your secularism. Got it. But part of me actually agrees with that, because let's be honest. How many politicians, when they say, our thoughts and our prayers, what does that mean? Your thoughts. What do your thoughts do? I mean, from the secular worldview, your thoughts are nothing more than electrical impulses between neurons in their brain. And they don't go outside of your cranium. What are they? They're nothing. So thoughts and prayers are nothing to a secularist. And if there is no consistent recognition of God's law and God's righteousness in your life, don't talk about thoughts and prayers. Don't even talk about prayers. In fact, I'll be perfectly honest with you. I am not one of those people. Put it this way, that has ever been out on the street banging the drum about public prayer. Well, the United States started going downhill and we took prayer out of the schools. No, it didn't. Prayer was taken out of schools because we have been going downhill for a long time. I believe prayer is an act of worship. And hence, I don't believe that forcing an act of worship upon unregenerate people is an appropriate thing to be done. I really don't. So this whole thing about thoughts and prayers, I just, unless you are seriously saying that I am a person of prayer, and I am going to ask Jesus, well, I'm going to ask Jesus to do what? Because see, when I first saw this, when I first heard about this, my first thought was, how dare anyone say that God has to fix this? Now, hold on, folks. Have any of you listened to what I said after 9/11? Long time ago now. Long time. Man, coming up on 15th anniversary. Long time ago. I've been pretty... Man, the memes are amazing. I've been pretty consistent on this, and I don't take a popular position. It's less popular now than it was after 9/11. After 9/11, I said, you want to talk about God bless America? Yeah, God bless America with heartfelt, soul-shaking repentance. That's the only blessing America needs. And it's only gotten worse, a lot worse, since 2001. God's under no obligation to fix anything. God's only obligation is to glorify himself. And if your theology is that God is best glorified when we are most pampered, well, then I don't know where you got that theology. You didn't get it from the Bible. You didn't get it from Christian history or anything else. And the idea that it's God's role and God's job to be running around comforting us is unbiblical. It's unbiblical. Nobody who's ever seriously read the Bible, seriously, you know, taking it face value, has ever come up with that idea. All this fluffy neo-evangelicalism we have in the world today has not accurately represented the biblical text. God is about God, and God's kingdom is about God's kingdom. It's not about us. It's all about him. And so, if you have the idea that God should be fixing this, maybe he is fixing it. What would judgment look like? In other words, what an amazing thing that we have so many people in our society that think God is under obligation to keep us safe and prosperous and healthy and give us plenty of food. All these blessings are supposed to come from God on a people who do what? On a people who do what? Has anything been done about Planned Parenthood since the movies came out demonstrating that they make the Nazis look like amateurs? No. Will anything be done? No. How about just that whole murdering unborn children thing? Going right on. How about our love of every form of sexual debauchery? How about we just redefine what God defined as marriage and now extend it to multiple people and the same-sex couples and all that kind of stuff? Look at the lists of vices and sins that the Bible says bring God's judgment and wrath upon anyone. Then go to your local college campus and you tell me what basis anyone has to say that God is under any obligation to do anything other than to bring judgment upon Western civilization as a whole. Sorry. But as I mentioned, I recently had to read the blessing and cursing passages in Deuteronomy from the pulpit. If you want to see how serious God is about this stuff, read Deuteronomy 26 and following. Just read on through the end. It may trouble you greatly. Should, anyways. I don't know how anybody can read that and not be troubled. Not be made to think, not be made to consider their own ways. That certainly makes me consider mine. In anyway, that wasn't, I don't think that's what the Daily News was saying. I think they were mocking people who think that God could do anything at all, to think that prayers could do anything at all. They think, well, they are praying to their God. It's government. Government's the answer to everything. Communists are that way. I mean, the government, the state, is the all in all for communists. And I'm just going to be straight out and say it. Our nation has been taken over by communists. They snuck in, changed their name, hired an advertising firm, took over the educational system, dumbed everybody down. Now they're in charge. Pretty simple. And they're praying to their God. Their God is the state. And the state can fix everything. So the state can end the gun scourge by just simply, can't have them anymore. Disarm everybody. You know, and it really goes against everybody sort of sitting around right now. Common sense would be, you know, we might need to defend ourselves. These people are coming after us. And the state says, trust us. We'll take care of you. Yeah, I like the thing. 9/11, state-sponsored prayer line. You know, 911, call 911, state-sponsored prayer line. Have I mentioned I love rooibos tea? And I thank you very much for my love. What? If I stick my pinky out, if I try to do the devil's thingy there, I'm going to spill the tea all over myself, and somebody will say it's just punishment, too. So, come on. Be nice to me. I'm not that bad. All right. There you go. I'm turning off the God isn't fixing this because God doesn't need to fix this. Right before I left the house to come down here, I'm flying out in the morning. Again, folks in St. Charles, hope you'll come out. I plan on playing, for example, I'll play Graham Codrington's opening statement. We're going to be looking carefully at all the key texts and doing a lot of questions and answers, things like that. In fact, better be careful. If we have time, might even do some role playing. That would be interesting. Somebody in jail just asked, Roibus, isn't that Latin for Satan? Yeah. I'm going to have to go back.
We might need to just get some clips of Dana Carvey, the church lady.
The church lady.
Maybe it's
Satan. Yes. When we started, there were a number of comments about my beautiful, new Coogee sweater. Bright. Coogees are supposed to be bright. And I will actually be wearing this in St. Charles as well, just so people know, just so they're prepared. That's actually a tradition. You put the microphone down, huh? Wisdom after all these years, finally. Instead of go for it, buddy, it's Yeah, I hear you. I love my Coogee sweaters. I love colorful stuff. And this one is perfect for Phoenix. It is incredibly light. It really is. I'm not sweating or anything. This would not work in northern climes because there's almost nothing to it. It's really, really super comfortable. Love it. One of those eBay snipes. It's the only way to get them anymore. That'll make them better. Right as I was coming down here, I saw an article, and I just have to look at it. And if we have to go a little long, we'll see how this works. I still want to get to the Copan thing if I can. But this was on the Gospel Coalition blog, which made me go, huh? How did this get on the Gospel Coalition blog? Dated today, December 3rd, and this text was taken from Same-Sex Attraction and the Church, The Surprising Plausibility of the Celibate Life by Ed Shaw from InterVarsity. All right, I'm troubled by this. Here's what's up. I was recently on a panel talking about same-sex attraction at a large Christian conference. One of the questions I was asked was a thinly veiled version of the one question many Christian parents most want to ask me: how can I stop my children from being same-sex attracted? Or, as no one has really had the courage to put it, how can I stop my child from becoming like you? Now, let me just stop. I could never begin to think of what a tragedy it would be to have a same-sex attracted child. I understand that there are Christians who experience same-sex attraction. I understand that. I don't deny that. I'm not one of those people that says, oh, no, it's it's all, no one experiences that naturally. I do not think the majority of homosexuals experience same-sex attraction naturally. I do think the vast majority had some experience in their life that damaged their sexuality. Of course, we all have a damaged sexuality. Every single one of us. We live in a fallen world. We've all been exposed to things that have damaged our sexuality. Whether you're heterosexual or whether you experience same-sex attraction. But I don't see how anyone can argue from a Christian perspective that same-sex attraction is not in and of itself a disordered thing. The Pope got the terminology right on that, by the way. It's disordered. It's not natural. It is not appropriate. The desire itself is a desire for an inappropriate thing. Heterosexual attraction is how God made men and women. That's how the species continues. And it can be perverted. It can be experienced in excess. But it is still a natural attraction, similar to gluttony. Eating is a natural thing. Not eating is not a natural thing. Eating humans is a very unnatural thing, okay? But you can have a excessive desire for food that becomes gluttony. But a man is to be naturally attracted to a woman, not to a man. And if you experience that attraction, it is a disordered thing. It's not a natural thing. It is not a good thing in and of itself. And I fear that a lot of folks are abandoning this. I'm not sure why. I'm not sure what the reasons would be, other than to maybe look more open-minded or something. I don't know. But it seems like a lot of folks are grabbing hold of the idea that in reality, same-sex attraction is a natural thing for certain people, just as heterosexual attraction is for others. And therefore, it's a morally neutral thing. It's just the way they are. It just so happens that God says, don't act on that one, but you can't act on this one, but they're both natural. And I don't think that follows. Now, what that means is, I believe that a Christian who experiences same-sex attraction needs to realize that the desire is sinful as well as the action. And should continuously not only avoid the action out of love for God and his ways, but pray that God would change the orientation and the desires as well. And I know there are people who say, I've prayed. That's not been my experience. I can't enter into that. I don't know. But as I understand what 1 Corinthians 6 is saying, when it says, such were some of you, there is a supernatural power of God to change the human heart. So with that said, I continue with the article. It's a revealing question. The number of times I've been asked it, always in roundabout ways, demonstrates how great a fear it is for many Christian parents to raise a child who might be sexually attracted to their own sex. It's not something they want to have to share in the Christmas letter in years to come, either openly or by what's clearly left unsaid. The great hope is that they'll be able to write of happy marriages, numerous grandchildren, and continued involvement in a good evangelical church. They don't want to have to say instead that a child is gay, that there won't be any grandchildren, at least not in the conventional way, and that their son or daughter is now part of some LGBT-affirming church, if any church at all. What they want from me is a few simple steps they can take to stop that from happening. Ban their young son from playing with his sister's dollhouse and discourage that sister from playing football when she's older. Then subtitle, Tragic Connection. Why the paranoia, a word honestly used by a Christian parent asking me this question? It's because, paranoia? That's not paranoia. That's not paranoia at all. You're not paranoid if you want your child to experience a meaningful human sexual existence. It's not paranoia to be to want grandchildren. It's not paranoia to want to have a son-in-law or a daughter-in-law. It's because far too often in the evangelical church, godliness is heterosexuality, and no one can grasp how same-sex attraction and godliness could exist together. Wrong. Wrong, I'm sorry. Godliness is not heterosexuality. But homosexuality cannot be godly. Heterosexuality can be godly or ungodly. But only a heterosexual married relationship can be godly. Never a homosexual married relationship or any homosexual orientation activity at all. It can't be godly. It is fundamentally disordered. So I don't know, if he's saying, well, people are just willing to allow their children, as long as they're not off, they've not spiraled off into just insane evil, and they're just a good heterosexual person with kids, then they're godly. Okay, if that's what he's talking about, then I would agree that's not enough to be godly. But given the context we're in right now, that's not the issue. The context we're in right now is people trying to say you can make homosexuality a godly thing. And no one can grasp how same-sex attraction and godliness could exist together. They can exist together as long as the one is leading a person to deny and reject the other. Not embrace it. Not embrace it and allow it to be self-identifying. So if you want your children to be godly, you must do all you can to ensure they're heterosexual. And obviously, if your child starts experiencing same-sex attraction, you must do all you can to change that as quickly as you can. I have a feeling a lot of these folks have jumped on the there can't be any change bandwagon. That has become the new... Have you noticed Bob Gagnon has been speaking against that movement recently? I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, but I guess he just gave a paper at ETS on let's not throw reparative therapy under the bus. All this explains how much time, effort, and money some churches have invested in counseling that promises a permanent change in someone's sexuality. Many same-sex attracted children of evangelical parents have been signed up for reparative therapy or sent off on residential courses that will heal them of their same-sex attraction. Often the children, sometimes the parents, have then given up on evangelical Christianity when these attempts have failed. If godliness is heterosexuality, what's the point of trying to be a Christian when you're not a heterosexual? Well, there are a boatload of presuppositions packed into that. It sounds like, and this wouldn't shock me that any Christian publisher would publish something now that would be in any way positive toward homosexuality. I can't think of a one that hasn't shown a willingness to do something like that. But is the statement here that there should not be residential courses, there should not be counseling, that they always fail? Is that the assertion being made? It's sort of smuggled in there, isn't it? And you better not do that because then they'll just give up on evangelical Christianity. Well, my theology tells me that if someone gives up on their faith, that tells me something about where they were to begin with. Maybe that's not where yours comes from. And if you've got a theology where the worst thing in the world is if someone abandons the faith, I think it's probably been a decade now since I preached those sermons, but they're still prominently displayed at the PRBC website. But Of course, that hasn't been touched in who knows how long. But I preached some sermons, and the title was The Blessing of Apostasy. The Blessing of Apostasy. And it was out of 1 John chapter 2, and the point was, you don't want hypocritical unbelievers staying in your church. They went out from us so it might be demonstrated they were not truly of us. There was a purpose, and it was a good purpose. And unless you have a sub-biblical view of what the church is supposed to be, where God is worshipped in purity and holiness, if you've got some other perspective, then you're going to misunderstand a lot of things, and here's part of it. Well, they might give up on evangelical Christianity. If what you're saying is they might give up on the faith, then they've never actually embraced the faith in the first place. Right? No, not for most folks. What's the point of trying to be a Christian when you're not a heterosexual? Well, if God has changed your heart, then the only thing I can understand why God would allow one of his children to continue experiencing same-sex attraction was that this person needs to be constantly on the battle line fighting against their sinful nature. It's just something they can never, ever look away from. It's that they've got to be focused upon it constantly. That for some reason, in God's purposes, maybe the people to whom they're going to minister, something coming up in their life, I'm not God, I don't know, but that's the only reason I can think of as to why God would allow that. Because God can change someone's heart, unless you're going to say, can't. It's tragic this link has been made in people's minds, but I understand why. It's a link that's often been at the forefront of my mind, too, if heterosexuality is godliness, which I reject. The big change that's most needed in my life is for me to become heterosexual. So I've prayed hard and searched hard for an effective antidote to my same-sex attraction. The pursuit of holiness has nearly always equaled the pursuit of heterosexuality for me. Are you saying that that is wrong? Is this individual saying, sounds like this individual is saying, I've given up the hope that God can actually change my desires. I've given up on that. And so now I'm going to remain celibate, but I am going to say that my disordered desires are the way God intends me to be. I just can't act on them. Sort of like a penance type thing or something you have to do to, I don't know. Then under the subtitle, Flabbergasted and Refreshed, so I was helped enormously, hopefully like everybody else listening, by the reply of another panel member at that conference, a heterosexual minister. He runs his church's support group for same-sex attracted church members. He's also the married father of two sons. He said something like this, "We most of all want our boys to grow up as godly and mature Christians. Some of the most godly and mature Christians we know are same-sex attracted. So why should we be so afraid of them growing up as same-sex attracted?" Because it's disordered? I was flabbergasted by this reply. So am I. It finally blew apart my wrong presumption that same-sex attraction and godliness, like oil and water, don't ever mix. You want to bring them that close and say that this is a godly thing? I don't think that's what you're trying to do, but have you realized how close that is? It made me recall that some of those godly people that I've ever known have also experienced same-sex attraction. In fact, one of the Christian leaders I most respect as godly has been made so through his struggle with same-sex attraction. Sounds like his struggle against same-sex attraction to me. I just never heard the link made so clearly in such a moving way in context. But that panel member is a parent whose main ambition for his children is the right one, godliness, not heterosexuality. See, everything about this is wrong. It's disordered. It's standing on the wrong foundation, looking backwards through a mirror. I'm sure it doesn't mean he's praying his boys will grow up to be same-sex attracted, but his reply showed that he has what we should all care about in our response to the gospel of grace, Christ-likeness. Being like Jesus is the true biblical definition of godliness. Right, being like Jesus is the true biblical definition of godliness. But what does that have to do with same-sex attraction? What, if you experience it, you resist it. You don't become comfortable with it. You don't become friendly with it. You don't embrace the idea that it's just the way I am. And I think a lot of people are beginning to embrace that idea because they don't want the lifelong struggle. They don't want the lifelong battle. So let's just say that it's not that central. In fact, let's just go ahead and allow it to define us as to who we are. I don't know how stuff is vetted for the Gospel Coalition blog, so I can't hold everybody accountable for everything that appears there. But I'm seeing some stuff there that makes me go, "Eh," recently. This keeps it warm, but not so hot that it burns your. You know, it actually helps the throat. That's good stuff. The more I drink it, the more I like it. Thankfully, I only have an old style teapot at home, and it takes forever to. Or I'd be drinking it all the time. All right, move this over here. One last thing here. Probably would have spent more time on this if we weren't right before our travel day. But I mentioned that there was an article that was posted November 30th. Does regeneration precede faith? Apparently not, by Paul Copen. It's fairly short. There are only 5 notes in it. I'll be perfectly honest with you. I do not get the feeling that the author has spent a great deal of time with Reformed writing. My understanding is that Dr. Copan's circle of influence is more the William Lane Craig area, definitely not a presuppositional Reformed perspective type thing there. And so what surprised me was that there was really no interaction both of the Reformed perspective as well as the primary Reformed texts and the primary Reformed arguments. Instead, you had, well, regeneration precedes faith. This affirmation is one that many Reformed tradition take as axiomatic. See, I would even disagree with that. We prove it scripturally. It's not an axiom that you bring to the text. It's derived from exegesis and from systematic theology. Why does regeneration precede faith? Well, there are certain fundamental things that come before this. And that is, we have a sovereign decree on God's part. We have man's deadness and sin. We have an unconditional election of God. I don't think Dr. Copan would necessarily agree with almost any of those in their full Reformed expressions. When you get to that I, which is generally where this comes from, the issues with irresistible grace is just simply the assertion that when God chooses to regenerate his elect, he does so without dependence upon them. That is, that he has the power and ability to regenerate, which is not the same thing as just a general salvific term. Regeneration is a specific term. It refers to a specific action. It's not the same thing as adoption. It's not the same thing as glorification. It's not the same thing as forgiveness. it is related to all of them, but how it is related to all of them is what's up for grab here. And the assertion is that God regenerates so that we can have spiritual life, and that repentance and saving, abiding faith are functions of a spiritually living person, not a spiritually dead person. And so if you're going to address this, you're going to have to address Reformed understanding of the nature of man, deadness in sin. You're going to have to deal with Romans chapter 8, not just the golden chain, though somewhat relevant, but to earlier in the chapter, where it is said that those who are according to the flesh cannot do what is pleasing to God. They can't do it. Or Jesus' statements. The reason you don't hear me is because you do not belong to God. Those who belong to God, hear my voice. There's no one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up last day. All these statements of inability, incapacity on man's part due to his fallen nature, they have to be taken into consideration. Then the texts that describe both repentance and faith as the gifts of God to his elect people need to be brought into consideration as well. Why would it have to be a gift? Why would it have to be, why is the Spirit so often connected with that? Why can Paul just in passing say, it has been given to you not only to believe in him, but to suffer for his sake? Philippians 1:29. What do you mean it's been given to you to believe? Why can Peter talk about to those who've received a like precious faith? Is that just the Christian faith as a whole? Or faith itself? Why is faith included in Ephesians chapter 2? That not of yourselves is the gift of God. That gift is wrapping up everything in the preceding section. The grace, the salvation, and the faith. So, faith is described as a gift. God's kindness leads you to repentance. The gift of repentance. And then you have these radical descriptions of what regeneration actually is. The taking out of the heart of stone, the giving the heart of flesh, the wind blowing across the valley of the dry bones. The dry bones can't put themselves together. Hearts of stone do not choose to become hearts of flesh. God's initiative must come first, and it must be a powerful and effective initiative. Not just a, well, I'm going to bring everybody to a moral neutral point, then it's up to them, prevenient grace type of duct tape to try to hold a synergistic system together. You just can't find that in Scripture. You have to make that up and read it in. Problem is, all of that material in regards to the importance of, well, the whole foundation. The fact that, for example, well, we've mentioned it before. I turned that off, didn't I? I'm going to give this to you if you want it. You may not want it. It's up to you. I've mentioned before this text, and I'm going to blow it up so it's nice and big because that's what you can do. And I like large fonts. Whoever, 1 John 5:1, whoever believes that Jesus, well, let's just go over the Greek. Everyone believing that Jesus is the Christ has been born from God. And this last section here is very, very interesting. And whoever loves, the New American Standard says the Father loves the child born of him. But you'll notice the word Father is not found here anywhere. It's literally the begetting one. And all the ones loving the begetting one loves also the one begotten, having been begotten from him. You can see why most translations don't bother trying to be overly literal at that particular point in time. Anyway, here's the key right here. Everyone believing that Jesus the Christ has been born from God. Now, Elsewhere in 1 John, in fact, I believe it's 4. Yeah, 4:7. Look at this. Everyone loving has been born from God. The whole text is, beloved, let us love one another, for love is from God, and everyone who loves is born of God and is knowing God, literally. So you have pos with ha agapon. This is the same type of construction we have in John 3:16. Everyone believing. Here's everyone loving. So if you're as a Christian, if you're experiencing Christian love, the reason is because you have been born from God. It's not, you don't become born from God by showing perfect Christian love. In fact, the biblical teaching would be you can't do that. Your heart is a heart of stone. You're a rebel. You're dead in your sins, trespasses and sins. So the point is that the use of this term right here, gegenetai, you'll notice down below, you probably can't see it on the screen, it's probably too small, and I can't blow those fonts. Well, yes, I can. Doink, doink, doink. Let's see what that does. Yeah, look at that. Don't tell accordance what it can and cannot do. Let me see if I can bring that up a little bit so it gets a little bit bigger. Oh, very good. So, gegenetai, you see that? The parsing on the right hand, well, it's on both sides. Third singular, perfect. Perfect. Passive. So, for those of you who know Greek, you see the epsilon reduplication, so on and so forth. The sign of the perfect. Without getting into a lot of detail here, when you have the perfect together with, and here is a participle that is a, since it has the article, it's functioning primarily as a substantive. But participles are those wonderful things that have, they're a mixture of noun and verb together. And this is a present active functioning as a substantive, everyone loving. So when you have participle together with a perfect finite verb, as you have here, there's a relationship between the actions. And what's being said here is, if you are loving, present tense, right, if this is, you know, this is how we demonstrate that we are walking in the light, we love the brethren, so on and so forth. If that love is the reality in your life, it's because you have been born from God. It is not what makes you become born from God. Now, why do I show that to you? Well, because I think, if I recall correctly, and I didn't have time to look at this, but it's in chapter 2, maybe somebody in channel could pop it up faster than I could find it, but, musical interlude. There's also a reference in chapter 2. Is it right there? Well, no, it's not. I should have just looked up born. And I would have been able to find it faster than just scanning through it like this. But there's a parallel text in chapter 2 as well that refers to being born. So I'm just going to go back to 4:9. Was it 4:9 we were at? Yes. Oh, it wasn't 4:9. Where was it? 4:7? Yes, there it is. I wonder if I could do this. Search for inflected. It didn't like that. It's not cooperating. Anyway, running out of time here. There's another parallel passage earlier in 1 John that I could have jumped to if I had bothered to look at my notes real quick. Point is, when you look at 1 John 5:1, whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ born from God, here once again, here is your gegenetai, and here is your pasha. Instead of loving, it's believing. So instead of agapon, it's pistuon. But it's a direct parallel. Direct parallel. So if John is consistent, then what is coming first here? Being born from God. And that is why, if you are believing that Jesus is the Christ, if you have a true, abiding, lasting, true faith that Jesus is the Christ, it's because you have been born from God. It's not what caused you to be born from God. It is because you have been born from God. Now, I would think that if you're going to write an article against the Reformed tradition at this point, that you might want to address the foundational reasons and then some of the texts that we utilize about the deadness of man, incapacity of man to believe, John 8, John 6, 1 John 5:1, Philippians 1:29. You might want to maybe interact with some of those and say, this is why this cannot be, or this is why they're wrong to look at it that way, or something along those lines. Might be the way. 1 John 2:29. Thank you, RK in channel. How did I miss it? Because it was I went too far into 1 John 2. Yes. Okay. Throw it up there real quick. 1 John 2:29. Pas ha poion tein dekaiasunein ex autu gegenetai. There is gegenetai. There is your pas ha poion. Here it is, everyone doing. Everyone doing righteousness has been born from him. So that's even clearer than four, because are you going to say that by doing righteousness you cause yourself to be born? Well, there are works righteousness folks that would say that, but hopefully Dr. Copan would not say that. So John is very, very consistent. Thank you for the channel help there. All right, so brief response there. I no Reformed person who knows their stuff is going to be overly troubled by the article, but it just struck me that the article didn't seem to indicate that Dr. Copan really was meaning to interact with where we're actually coming from, which is unfortunately regular. We covered a bunch of stuff today, didn't we? We certainly did, and we did so in Coogee style. What's that? I need to keep my fingers like this. Oh, man. Every Twitch now is going to be like, Yeah, no, I'm not going to go like that. I'm going to, here, snap, take a picture of you going like that and go, see, that's what's really going on. Anyway, we've covered a lot today. Thanks for watching Dividing Lines. Hope to see a bunch of you in St. Charles over the weekend. And Lord willing, we'll be back next week or... See you then. God bless.